Self-Evident is a podcast that is dedicated to speaking truths that were once self-evident and doing so in love. Hail and well met, everyone. Welcome to the first recycled episode of our podcast. I know, hear me out. It's one worth listening to again. Back in March of 2023, which it's crazy that 2023 is literally 2 years ago, my co-hosts, Eliana, Kenna Rose, and Alyssa and I investigated the topic of legalizing euthanasia, why it was morally and ethically wrong, etc. The reason I'm bringing this episode back is because Illinois is on the cusp of making assisted suicide legal here in 2025. Senate Bill 9 can be called for a vote any day on the state Senate floor, and if passed, will allow doctors to prescribe lethal drugs for a patient to end their own life. The sponsor of this legislation, Senator Linda Holmes of the Aurora area, is only a few votes away from passing it. So please, if you live in Illinois, after listening to this episode, please call your state lawmakers and ask them to vote no to Senate Bill 9.
Euthanasia has been a very divisive topic in Western history, and rightly so. We're talking about literally giving a doctor the ability to determine whether or not someone's life is worth living, and not only the doctor, but the person themselves.
That can't go wrong at all.
Right? And like literally attempting to take life and death out of the hands of God and put it into your own, basically, and to the doctors.
We shall become as gods.
Exactly. And euthanasia first appeared in Western societies in 1870 through Samuel Williams, who wasn't a doctor, wasn't a physician, and he first made the case that doctors should have the wherewithal to provide a peaceful death to their patients. Obviously, his remarks sparked a huge debate in the United States as well as Britain regarding euthanasia. Shocker, Ohio actually attempted to legalize it shortly thereafter in 1905, but was ultimately defeated. Euthanasia was kind of put at a bit of a rest until 1997 in June in America, when a handful of physicians took this matter to the Supreme Court with the case Washington versus Glucksberg. So Dr. Harold Glucksberg, along with four other physicians, prosecuted the state of Washington for banning and criminalizing medically assisted death. They claimed it was unconstitutional. Their position on this came that banning it was going against the Due Process Clause of the Constitution, which, as just a brush up for those listening, says that no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any states deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction equal protection of the law.
So basically they were saying like, oh, you cannot take away our privilege to kill ourselves or exactly. to help other people kill themselves.
And exactly.
Isn't the due process clause technically the clause by which they claimed Roe v. Wade
That's
could
true.
Be legal?
That's true.
Exactly. At first glance, you know, euthanasia and the abortion discussion doesn't seem they're that similar. But as you start to look at them, you realize it really is just the exact same thing under a different set of clothes.
Where are the arbitrary lines that make a human?
These all have to do with the sanctity of human life. The reason I'm giving a little more context to this specific case is because of Chief Justice Rancourt. Well, this chief's summary. The court ruled unanimously against Glucksberg's opining that the right to assisted suicide is not a fundamental liberty interest protected by the Due Process Clause, since its practice has been, and continues to be, offensive to our national traditions and practices. The court concluded that the ban on assisted suicide was rationally related to the state of Washington's pursuit in protecting medical ethics, shielding the disabled and terminally ill from prejudice, which might persuade them to end their lives. That was in 1997. Fast forward to today. In Canada, they're well on their way to legalizing euthanasia for their youth.
Yeah, so they have like everything else legalized for consenting adults and things like that.
And even pushing for without parental consent, so a child, a literal child, can just go for assisted suicide.
And statistics have shown that today's generation of kids is actually worse off in their mental health than ever before.
Right. Teen suicide is through the roof. And apparently, especially with teen girls, the suicide rate is 30% higher than in boys.
Wow. That's so sad.
Yeah.
So I can only imagine this is going to make it so much worse because
life in general is
exactly. Hard. When you give us an option as a way out.
And that's another ironic thing that I'm trying to make the two make sense is there's a huge push against teen suicide, right? Now all of a sudden we're talking about, no, legal suicide. So on the one hand, teens are being told like, no, suicide's wrong. And then on the other hand, they're like, oh, but if a doctor tells you you can do it, absolutely, it's fine.
It's evidence of a very morally confused society.
Alex Schadenberg of the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition states that now the Canadian government is considering child euthanasia and euthanasia of incompetent persons who requested death in an advance directive. The requirement to consent to die has become only an option. And that is very scary to think about.
Do you know how euthanasia was started in Germany? A father contacted Hitler, who was the supreme leader at the time, and said, my son has been born missing part of his leg, part of his arm, and he's blind. My son is an idiot. The doctors are telling me that I can't kill him. Can you come help me, please? And so Hitler sent his own personal physician to examine the boy and then instructed the hospital to euthanize this child.
Wow.
And that was how euthanasia was started in Germany, to kill off a special needs little boy.
Yeah, and Nazi Germany came up with a hospital situation for euthanasia. So they would take kids with disabilities or learning issues, anything that brought, or the elderly, anything that brought difficulty to the family, they would take them to this special hospital. They would send letters to the family saying, you know, we're taking care of your child, we're taking care of this person. Little did they know that they were going to a euthanasia camp. That's kind of what started the concentration camps eventually, was euthanasia. And then family members would get letters in the mail saying that their loved one had passed away while in treatment, things like that. Everything in Nazi Germany started with a improper and demonic view of human life, who is able and who has the authority to take it. Like Eliana was saying, this is on our doorstep. This is what abortion is about, that you have the right to end a human life just because it's in a location you don't like, just because it's a financial strain that you're not ready for, that gives you the right to end human life. Same thing with euthanasia. If you have a family member that is really difficult to deal with due to physical issues, due to mental issues, because, you know, life is hard for you, you now have the right to end that person's life. Yeah. Or if life is hard for you personally, you have the right to end your own life. That's totally okay.
And pretty soon, that right to die becomes the duty to die.
Yeah. There was another story of a 86-year-old woman who was a dementia patient, and her son and daughter signed the medically assisted suicide for her, then proceeded to hold her down because she was struggling against the injection as the doctor injected her.
That is, it's heartbreaking.
Is that consent?
Absolutely not. And see, these new laws being created creates this environment where things like that are able and allowed to happen. I'm not saying that it is, but even if assisted suicide in and of itself was okay, it still opens the door to all of these other things that are just abominations and horrible.
They always say that, oh, this is the last door we're opening. No, opening one door always leads to another.
It never ends.
When I was a freshman, I was a psychology major. I am no longer a psychology major, but when I was, I studied a lot of human development. I studied a lot of human psychology and why people behave the way that they do. What in our human nature makes us respond to certain stimuli, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, The topic that came up in one of our classes had to do with human behavior and authority and followers, that we have this natural desire to follow, some to lead, things of that nature.
Okay.
And Nazi Germany was brought up because the question was raised, how could normal people do the things that they did to others? Like, what in their minds made them submit to an authority figure that asked them to do such evil and torturous things to others? Mm-hmm. And it was called the Milgram Experiment, and it was studied at Yale University in the 1960s. It was called the Milgram Experiment because psychologist Stanley Milgram conducted a series of obedience tests. And what he would do is he would put white robe on, okay, and he would bring people in, and he would have a plant that he had, not an actual plant, but like a human plant that was in on the experiment, have him in another room, and tell the person that they were experimenting on, when I tell you, you're going to shock this person with a certain number of voltages for a stimuli experiment. That's what they told their subjects. Anyway, they would do it because the doctor, the authority figure, told them to do it. And as the voltages got larger, the human plant would be instructed to scream or to say, please stop, etc., to push back against the experiment. And what you saw in the test subjects was they were getting really nervous that, wait, am I hurting someone? Is everything okay? And they would always turn to the doctor and say, is everything okay? Like, I don't want to hurt anyone. And the doctor would say, please proceed with the experiment. And that's all that the doctor would say. What Stanley Milgram found is, if there's an authority figure, if there's a doctor, if there's a sergeant, if there's something, if there's an authority figure in a position of authority, people are likely, even if they're committing heinous acts, they're going to do it because it's human nature.
Yeah. You're considered like, oh, this person's telling me it's okay. So thus, my conscience is wrongly informed.
Right. You know, you might be wondering, Alyssa, why are you bringing up a subject of, you know, a psychology test that was run in the 1960s? Well, I bring this up because we're seeing this with euthanasia. It's a doctor. It's an authority figure that's saying this is okay. They're a doctor. They took, you know, so many hours and hours and hours of classes studying how to be good people, how to help people. If this doctor is telling me that suicide, that
this is the only option to cure my depression,
then they must be right. I have to do this. And I think that's really interesting that America is falling for these evil devices exactly. that have been experimented on and found to be so evil.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking, really. And Alex Schadenberg, he was the executive director of the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition. He noted recently in a presentation that doctors self-report these cases. Oregon, I think?
Yeah, it's in Oregon.
You were saying, Alyssa, there is no accountability whatsoever. Doctors can prescribe or recommend death to whoever requests it on a mere whim. Someone can be having a bad day. Someone can be in pain. They can be like, oh, I want to be done.
PTSD.
That's all that's required. It becomes an option. There are proposed like safeguards that are put in place to make sure that there aren't any boundaries being overstepped. What we found is that these only protect the physician. They don't protect the victim. And so according to more research done by the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition, assisted death laws are designed to protect the physician or another who is willing to participate. These laws do not provide effective oversight and protection for the person who is being killed. These safeguards are designed to sell the legalization of assisted death to politicians who have concerns about killing, but they include exceptions that are wide enough to drive a hearse through.
No pun intended.
That's right. The state of Oregon was the first jurisdiction to legalize assisted death in 1997. The assisted suicide lobby did not challenge the safeguards in the law because they wanted to convince other jurisdictions that there is no slippery slope. I am doing quotation marks. However, in 2019, the assisted suicide lobby announced that the problem with assisted suicide laws is the restrictions. And this is when we see things start to kind of go downhill, and that one door open, we walk into, so they start to go to the next door. It doesn't end. When your moral boundary is whatever you feel like and whatever you think, there really is no limit to how far you can extend that line.
That's right.
That year, the Oregon legislature removed the 15-day waiting period.
And real quickly, the 15-day waiting period is if someone requests a medically assisted suicide and the doctor confirms them. So there's like a whole process that the person has to go through. They have to be analyzed by a doctor. They have to be analyzed by a psychiatrist. And if they all get the green light, like, oh, yes, your life is not worth living. Here, we can pass you on. You can go die. They pass all of those tests. They have to then wait for a period of about 15 days, and it varies state to state. Uh-huh. Like in California, I believe it's like 6 days. They have to wait a 15-day period in case they change their mind. So now Oregon got rid of that because of the assisted suicide lobby is like, oh, no, these restrictions, they make people second guess themselves, which is literally what it's supposed to do.
Exactly. And that's why that was put into place. And so that people who are having a bad day or having a bad moment don't just do so on a whim. Instead, it takes them some time to think about it and really consider it.
One thing that's very obvious as you start learning about euthanasia or abortion is that it really is less of like a battle of flesh and blood and more of a spiritual battle. Yeah. Because you can just see this desire for death and destruction of those made in the image of God.
Another thing the euthanasia lobby alleges is that the Netherlands have not changed their euthanasia law since it was passed in 2002. This, however, is inaccurate because although the language of Netherlands euthanasia law might not have changed, the interpretation of the law has. Canada is a prime example of a country where safeguards lack effective definition or meaning. And this is where changing the dictionary and controlling the dictionary really can change laws too, because we think the Constitution meant something when it was written. And often the debate is, well, what did they want it to mean? What was the intended meaning, right? And when you change the words and when you change, then you no longer have a set order of what things mean, and everything is open to interpretation. And that's where it gets to be a very dangerous game. And we're seeing that in other countries right now. For instance, Canada's euthanasia law required that a person's natural death be reasonably foreseeable. The meaning of this phrase was not defined, and consequently, the application of the law varied. In September 2019, a Quebec Superior Court decision struck this phrase from the law. Canada is also a prime example of how a euthanasia law can incrementally expand. Canada passed its assisted death law in June of 2016. In February 2020, Parliament introduced Bill C-7 to expand the law by eliminating the waiting period, permitting euthanasia of an incompetent person who requested assisted death in advance, and eliminating the terminal illness requirement. And this is when this gets also just extremely dangerous, because you think no longer are people being examined the way that they were. No longer is this taken and looking at as seriously as it was before. Now it's turned into more of the arbitrary. Life has become less than sacred. And
that information was from the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition. If you want more information about this, they have pamphlets that you can download and everything. I highly recommend them as a source. So basically, safeguards are just designed to politically sell these laws to legislatures so it can just get passed.
Exactly.
What are the arguments that people use for it? Why should we be against it? I know we touched on this like throughout the entire time that Eliana was talking about it.
It's hard not to.
Yeah, that's a really good question, because when we're talking about a topic like this, it's important to understand, or at least have a basic understanding of what both sides are saying, because you can't accurately argue a position if you don't know their key tenets.
Yeah.
Because of that, I'm just going to quickly run through the key arguments both for euthanasia and those that are against.
And this is from a secular source.
And this is from secular sources. A scholarly article from the 6th edition of Holland Free Cancer Medicine textbook lays out the chief debates for and against euthanasia really well, and I really want to run through them quickly. I'll have all of this linked in the description. Quote, individuals have different values and goals in life. We protect patient autonomy by permitting patients to pursue their goals. A proper death is an essential part of a person's goals and values as any other choice. Hence, to respect patients' autonomy, we must respect patients' wishes regarding the manner and timing of their death through euthanasia.
So basically what they're saying is it's their body, their choice.
Doesn't that sound vaguely familiar?
I think I've heard that somewhere, huh?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Second, it is argued that for some patients, the dying process inflicts significant pain and suffering, and that euthanasia, or PASS, may relieve them of these burdens. Hence, euthanasia, or PASS, which is physician-assisted suicide, furthers beneficence or the well-being of sick patients. Mm-hmm. Indeed, for some people, just knowing there is the possibility of having euthanasia or PASS may be psychologically beneficial, even if they never use these interventions.
Which is such a straw man argument, too.
So opposite of the Christian view of life, because the Christian view of life, there will be pain in this life and there will be suffering, but we can get through it by looking ahead to Christ, because
exactly.
We know we have life after death, and
yes.
We know there's a purpose and a reason for the pain. So
yeah.
You can just see how absolutely opposite the Christian worldview these arguments are,
yeah.
And how
and
sad it is.
Another secular argument for that is, well, why endure suffering when you can just eliminate it altogether right now?
Humans are made to worship. As humans, we are worshiping something. For us Christians, we choose to worship God, and that is really how it should be. And you see that when you worship God, not saying life is always easy, things go a lot better. The problem is in a godless society, is instead of having God on the throne, people put themselves on the throne. They put happiness on the throne, their own well-being, and really sacrificing things on the altar of themselves. It's such a problem to get into, because then you run into issues like these where human life is no longer sacred, human life no longer matters, is no longer something to fight for and protect. Now it's just, how am I happy? How am I going to make myself glad? How am I going to protect myself? What is the thing that is the most convenient for me? It's very heartbreaking, especially for people in this world who are elderly or who are less fortunate than others.
Third, proponents argue that euthanasia is morally indistinguishable from the accepted practices of withholding and withdrawing life-sustaining care. This is because the final result, the death of a patient, is the same in either scenario, and because there is no moral difference between acts of omission and acts of commission. From a moral standpoint, there is no difference between merely letting nature take its course and actively killing a patient if the patient consciously and knowingly requests his or her life to be terminated. Their sin of commission and omission, I think they're using biblical terms to try to make their point, and they're failing very badly. Because if you have a person who has a gunshot wound in a very vital organ of their heart, and you as a paramedic, you holding a claw trying to stop the bleeding is very different, even though they're still bleeding out and stuff like that. It's very different from you just standing there and saying, well, they're going to die anyway. Right. I'm not going to do anything. Right. I'm just going to stand here.
Right.
Well, they're dying, but you're at least trying to ease the suffering and pain. That's kind of what life support does.
So finally, it's argued that the adverse practical consequences of legalizing euthanasia or PASS are too speculative and hypothetical to determine whether to permit euthanasia or PASS. Indeed, permitting euthanasia or PASS should enhance the physician-patient relationship because it means physicians will provide whatever care, including euthanasia or PASS, that is necessary for dying patients.
And that goes above and beyond their Hippocratic oaths.
I was going to say, I don't know about
some
you guys.
Some hospitals don't require that anymore.
I don't know.
Really?
I don't know about you guys, but if my doctor had the ability to kill me, I would not trust them.
No. Why would you?
Good.
Yeah, don't sign anything with your eyes closed.
But then there's four parallel arguments for opponents of euthanasia. First, opponents claim that autonomy does not justify euthanasia or PASS. Autonomy does not mean a person should be permitted to do anything he or she wishes, especially those actions that end the ability to act autonomously.
Okay.
On this basis, we do not permit voluntary dueling or voluntary enslavement. In addition, even if a person wants to commit suicide, it is another issue entirely to permit others to help. If you notice in the laws of our land, it is illegal to prostitute yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And yet no one knows that. There are limits to your human autonomy.
Yeah.
When it was put in our Declaration of Independence that we have the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, you notice there's a tier order in that. You have life, you have liberty, and then you have pursuit of happiness.
Yeah.
And if you have anything above life, it gets disordered. And actually, Kristen Hawkins, who is the, I believe, director of Students for Life of America, notes that in a lot of her campus speeches that she gives on abortion, that there's an order and there's a proper delineation of our rights in government and in life. Okay, secondly, beneficence may not justify euthanasia or PASS. Many terminally ill patients experience inadequately treated pain, fatigue, and depression. If we treated these symptoms adequately, few people would have extreme pain and suffering that would justify euthanasia or PASS. Third, it is argued that there is an ethical distinction between acts of omission and acts of commission. Evaluating the ethics of an act does not only depend on its final result, but we also must evaluate how that result was produced and the intention of the actors. There are ethical and legal differences between cases in which a person was killed by mistake and cases in which the killing was premeditated.
Oh, you think?
Similarly, there is a difference between stopping a medical treatment and letting a patient die and intentionally and actively injecting the patient with a medication to cause his or her death.
It's the idea of the ends justify the means. If it's going to end in death anyway, why does it matter how?
Well, everyone's going to die anyway.
Yeah.
Why can't we go on killing rampages? Opponents note a variety of adverse consequences that might result from legalizing euthanasia or PASS, including disruption of the physician-patient relationship.
Yeah, like what Kenna said earlier, if my doctor has the ability to kill me, why on earth would I trust him?
Exactly. Intrusion of the courts into terminating care decisions, coercion of terminally ill patients to commit euthanasia or PASS, and extension of euthanasia to children, mentally incompetent patients, and others.
And you can already see that's happening.
Yeah. I want to go now to the actual etymology of the word euthanasia. According to the Online Etymology Dictionary, which, by the way, that's such a fascinating site to go on, euthanasia means a gentle, easy, happy death. And euthanasia in the United States is performed with a combination of multiple drugs, which the patient can either inject or swallow in pill form. And that is supposed to slip the patient into a coma, peacefully halt their ability to breathe. In a 2017 article by USA Today, the reporter reveals the different drug cocktails medical professionals have been using under death with dignity laws in different states. These drug cocktails are not what one would call gentle or happy means of finding your end. This is a quote from the article. The first Seconal, which is a certain drug, the first Seconal alternative turned out to be too harsh, burning patients' mouths and throats, causing some to scream in pain. The second drug mixed, that this was used 67 times, has led to deaths that stretched out hours in some patients, up to 31 hours in one case. And Ken and I recently went to a Speak Out Illinois conference where the executive director of Euthanasia Prevention Coalition, Alex Schadenberg, he gave a presentation, and he said actually some of these euthanasia attempts, it lasted up to 104 hours in one case. This person was slowly, their body was slowly shutting down. And I don't really think that's a very peaceful way to go if your throat is on. Anyways,
no, that's not ideal.
Especially since he described it as you're basically drowning.
So this is another quote from the article. 20% of the cases were 3 hours or more before death, which we think is too long, said Robert Wood, a retired HIV/AIDS researcher who volunteers with the advocacy group End of Life Washington, in an email. He said the longest death was 31 hours, the next longest 29 hours, the third longest 16 hours, and some 8 hours in length. Sean Riley, an end-of-life researcher studying in the Netherlands, and by the way, what's going on in the Netherlands is absolutely appalling. I just didn't go into that right now. This end-of-life researcher states that, quote, the pervasive belief that noxious drugs are guaranteed to provide for a peaceful and painless death must be dispelled. Modern medicine cannot yet achieve this. Certainly some, if not most, executions and suicides have been complication-free, but this notion has allowed much of the general public to write them off as humane and turn a blind eye to any potential problems. Execution, or pass, they have never been as clean as they appear, even with the U.S.'s medicalization efforts during the 1980s, mm-hmm. End of quote. So the idea that it's death with dignity and you're just peacefully slipping away is not necessarily true. Now, what specifically does the Bible say about euthanasia? And first and foremost, why is it wrong? Why, if God allows pain and suffering in the world and there's a way we can get out of it, why can't we just use it?
The first thing you notice when reading through the reasons they want to allow pass or euthanasia is because of the fact that it's hard, life hurts, they don't really want to deal with it. Back in the Garden of Eden, humanity separated themselves from a relationship with God. Nothing is going to be easy after we declare ourselves enemies of the creator of the universe. For those who are Christians and have a right relationship with God, we know that there's still going to be hard things in the world because of the fact that this world is under the dominion of the enemy, who wants pretty much the death of everything God created. Without a biblical understanding of life and death, we were talking about this earlier, there really is no reason. Why is life sacred? Well, without God, is life sacred? Why does God allow pain and suffering is literally the one question that is asked, I think, the most by people who are not believers and who want to know why a good God would allow pain and suffering. And it's a hard question to answer. For Christians, we know there's pain and suffering because of sin and because of the fact that God is refining us and bringing us closer to Him. We see in Romans 5 that as Christians, we are to rejoice in suffering because suffering produces endurance, endurance produces character, character produces hope, and hope does not put us to shame because God's love has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit who has been given to us. Or James 1, count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. We also know that God sometimes uses the hard things in this world to bring people to Him.
Even if it's not through their suffering, it's through the suffering of a believer.
And so you see in 1 Corinthians, blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and God of all comforts, who comforts us in our affliction, so that we may be able to comfort those who are in any affliction with the comfort which we ourselves are comforted by God. Or Psalm 119:67, before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now I keep your word. And verse 72 says, it is good for me that I was afflicted, that I might learn your statutes. And I think that's just an example of God taking that all the pain and hurt and everything that came on by sin. And it had to, because sin is evil and needs mm-hmm. a punishment.
Yeah. Those who he loves, he chastens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the book of Job is one of the most theological books in the Bible when it comes to a story of suffering. Yeah. You have this man that was righteous in God's eyes, and yet God allowed Satan to afflict him with so many trials, with so many devastations in his life. And Job gets to the point where he says, why? Why, God? Why did you allow this to happen to me? What did I do to inherit such devastation? What is there something that I did? Because his friends were telling him that it was something he did and that got in his head. I think God's answer is very interesting for believers to really take hold of. God's answer to Job is essentially that, Job, you're asking the wrong question. The question isn't, why did I allow this? The question is, who? Who are you holding on to? In the midst of trials, we don't know what God is producing in us. Sometimes we do know. Sometimes it's endurance. Sometimes it's patience. Sometimes it's compassion. Sometimes it's love, the fruit of the Spirit that's supposed to be evident in the believer's life.
Sometimes it's something we don't even know until years down the road.
Right. What God confronts Job with is his character. He says, were you there when I laid the foundation of the world? Were you there when I put the stars in the sky, when I set the universe in motion? Were you there when I filled the ocean with all the creatures? God leaves it at that. He confronts us with his character in the midst of trial and temptation. That would be one of my answers to anyone who asked me that question, specifically if they were a believer, that, you know, who are you holding on to?
Very much the sovereignty of God is what we need to think of. He's a good God, and we mm-hmm. know that. And so if he's a good God, then the reason there is this stuff in the world, it will be good in the end, and it will mm-hmm. glorify him in the end.
In conclusion, here are five reasons from the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition why medically assisted suicide shouldn't even be on the table. Firstly, it involves causing a person's death, and society should never allow one person to kill another. Safeguards only protect the physician. They do not protect vulnerable people. Third, it is fundamentally incompatible with the physician's role as healer. Fourth, doctors are fallible. They can make medical errors and misdiagnose conditions. They are humans, after all. And finally, legalization pressures physicians, who then pressure patients. What begins as a choice, like Kenna pointed out earlier, or a choice to die, becomes a pressure to kill and a pressure to die.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Self-Evident. And once again, please call your state senator if you live in Illinois and ask them to vote no to Senate Bill 9. For more information on euthanasia in Illinois, look over the articles and podcasts I've linked in this episode's description, and be sure to follow Self-Evident on Instagram to stay updated on the latest issues and trends. Until we meet again, let us firmly rely on the protection of divine providence. This is Self-Evident.